Intelligent design and DNA. Scholars can't explain it all away. Get ready to be awed by the handiwork of God. Tune in to Real Science Radio. Turn up the Real Science Radio.
Greetings to the brightest audience in the country. Welcome to Real Science Radio. I'm Bob Enyart. Fred Williams is on assignment. Today, we're going to talk about our list of the fine-tuning features of the universe. And I'd like to begin with a quote from Barrow and Tipler. You know those guys, Frank Tipler? Their classic treatment, the anthropic cosmological principle. Now, these are not creationists. They are cosmologists, astronomers, and they write this in their book. I have the book. I've read chunks of it. It's a classic. They write, there exist a number of unlikely coincidences between numbers of enormous magnitude that are superficially, apparently, completely independent. Moreover, these coincidences appear essential to the existence of carbon-based observers in the universe. And we now are going to look at a number of these. Are they coincidences? They are fine-tuned parameters of the universe, not only the universe and physics, but also of the Earth, on the Earth, in the solar system, the Earth, Sun, Moon system. There are so many coincidences that are just perfect for our existence. And to begin with, it's one I mentioned to Lawrence Krauss. He is the theoretical physicist, emphasis on the theoretical, that we had on this show about a year ago. With Lawrence Krauss, I mentioned some of these, and this one in particular, the electron to proton ratio in the universe. Now, if there's just an explosion, a big bang, and it produced matter, well, you get electrons, you get protons. But when you look at the ratio, you know, among human beings, you have babies, right? You have boys and girls. And it sort of works out. Like if we had 90% boys and 10% girls, a real problem would be brewing. So if we were to look at all the human beings on the Earth and we found out that it was 50-50 men and women, now it's not exact, right? But men tend to die earlier. We do more dangerous things, for one. And if it was exactly 50-50, not like rounded off to the nearest millionth or thousandth or hundred, but actually exactly one man for one woman, exactly out of 7 billion people in the world, that would freak us all out, right? That'd be like, wow, why is it exact? That's weird. What a coincidence. Well, with electrons and with a billion people, that's 10 to the ninth, right? That's a billion. And so 7 times 10 to the ninth, that would be with a 1 in 10 to the ninth ratio. If we had exactly the same number of men and women, we don't. But imagine that. That'd be uncanny. What if it was 10 to the 12th? Then you're talking about trillion. 1 to the 15th, quadrillion. 1 to the 18th, quintillion. 1 to the 21st, sextillion. 1 to the 24th, septillion. 1 to the 27th, octillion. 1 to the 30th, nontillion, right? We have the electron to proton ratio in the universe has a standard deviation of 1 in 10 to the 37th. That means there's the exact same number of electrons to protons to add 37 zeros. It's 1 in 10 to the decillion other possibilities. And there it is, perfect. The standard deviation of the number of electrons to protons. Then there are also uncanny relationships that are just perfect for life to exist. The electron to proton mass ratio, the gravitational force constant. You know, the four forces, the strong force, the weak force, the electromagnetic force, the gravitational force constant. The gravitational force constant, the electromagnetic force constant. These are described by physicists as being wildly unlikely to have their particular value in the enormous magnitude that theoretically they could take, and they're exactly what they need to be to allow for life to exist. And the electromagnetic force in the right ratio to the nuclear force in the right ratio. So Krauss and all these atheists and others, they claim that the anthropic principle answers why these extraordinarily unlikely precise values exist, including 1 in 10 decillion odds against us having electron to proton standard deviation, 1 to 10 decillion. And their answer for this is, well, if it wasn't that way, we wouldn't be here now, would we? In that way, they deflect attention onto the observer and away from the very thing being observed, away from the design of the universe that they are pretending to explain. So Stephen Hawking, you know him, he's that insignificant guy in England. He's insignificant, right? He's not important because he says the whole earth is insignificant. So if the whole world is insignificant, surely he must be insignificant. So that insignificant guy in a wheelchair, Stephen Hawking, he admits, now he's faithfully adhering to the anthropic doctrine, of course. He has to, right? Otherwise, you end up believing in God, and he hates God. But he admits, let me quote him, in his Brief History of Time, page 129, he says, "The remarkable fact is that the value of these numbers seem to have been very finely adjusted to make possible the development of life." Isn't that cool? Right? Why would an explosion care billions of years later whether life showed up? Explosion wouldn't care. It couldn't care. It's inanimate. So he says, this is Stephen Hawking. This is the preeminent Big Bang atheist cosmologist in the world. Says the remarkable fact is that the values of these numbers seem to have been very finely adjusted to make possible the development of life. You know, that's like Richard Dawkins. He says biology is the study of things that appear to have been designed. So that's why I started my interview with Lawrence Krauss saying, well, you guys admit fully half of the argument, fully half of it. You guys admit that the universe and life appears to be designed. So now we're only arguing about whether there is a designer. But you admit it appears to be designed, you guys, you know, as a group. So then Stephen Hawking continues. He says, for example, if the electric charge of the electron had been only slightly different, stars either would have been unable to burn hydrogen and helium, or else they would not have exploded as we have beautiful supernovae, so we couldn't enjoy them. So if the electron charge was a little different, stars wouldn't burn. The sun wouldn't burn. In Hawking's book, The Grand Design, he quotes a famous astronomer, Fred Hoyle. And so Stephen Hawking writes that Hoyle wrote, quote, "I do not believe that any scientist who examined the evidence would fail to draw the inference that the laws of nuclear physics have been deliberately designed with regard to the consequences they produce." Isn't that cool? So Fred Hoyle, Hawking puts it in his book, and then he immediately adds, quote, "At the time, no one knew enough nuclear physics to understand the magnitude of the serendipity that resulted in these exact physical laws." That's on page 159 of Hawking's book, Brief History of Time. It's on page 159. It can't be too brief now, can it? That's like when people are telling you a story, then they say, well, to make a long story short, it's like, well, it's too late for that. This year, 2013, New Scientist, that's the big science magazine in Britain, New Scientist reported, and in today's show summary at realscienceradio.com, we'll put a link to this article, okay? New Scientist reported about gravity and acceleration. Think about that. Two different things, right? Acceleration and gravity. This is what they wrote. That a large chunk of modern physics is precariously balanced on a whopping coincidence. For regarding gravitational and inertial mass, quote, these two masses are always numerically exactly the same. The consequences of this coincidence are profound. Now, most people don't understand physics enough to even know what in the world they're talking about. At least you could recognize that they are saying, here's another whopping coincidence. Whopping. So when we look at the fine-tuning for stars to exist, the fine-tuning necessary for life to exist, it's just so wonderfully cool. Think about the fine-tuned parameters of the Earth. Earth's orbit is nearly circular. Now go back to Johann Kepler. Remember the father of modern astronomy, the three laws of planetary motion. Planets, they orbit in an ellipse, not in a circle. That was a big mistake that was given to us back by Plato in his geocentrism. Plato and Aristotle, that the sun went around the earth and the planets went around the earth and the stars went around the earth. Geocentrism. And then it was taken up by Ptolemy. And these pagans developed this theory of geocentrism, but the atheists blamed the church for it. Isn't that funny? Why don't you blame Plato? He's one of your guys. They blame the church. Okay. But what Johann Kepler realized, and he is an extraordinary creationist, he realized that the planets circle the sun, as does the earth, but not in a circle. They orbit in an ellipse, which is sort of like a squished circle, sort of, in layman's terms. If it's a perfect circle, it has an eccentricity of zero. And the more elliptical, the more elongated the orbit is, the higher the eccentricity. Well, the Earth's is almost a perfect circle. It has an eccentricity of 0.02. That's a very small eccentricity. If it was big, if we came real close to the sun and then went real far away from the sun and then we came back real close and we went real far, what would happen to life on Earth? It would burn to a crisp at our, what is it called, perihelion. And then at the aphelion, everything would freeze to death, right? And so the fact that the Earth's orbit is virtually circular is a wonderful example of the fine-tuning of the parameters of our solar system for life. The Earth-Moon relationship is so fabulous for us. The Moon has a nearly circular orbit. You know, other planets have moons that do all kinds of weird stuff. Don't even think about Pluto and Charon. You know, they just, the Earth's moon is nearly circular. Its eccentricity is 0.05. Otherwise, imagine the tides if the moon came real close to the Earth, just grazed us, just outside the Roche limit maybe, and then it went way far away. And we have just the right ozone layer to protect us from the sun's dangerous rays, radiation. The Earth's spin rate, you know, if it was slower or faster, forget about global warming. Forget it. Be global toast. The atmospheric pressure. The phenomenally complex and harmonious water cycle. You think you know about the water cycle? Study the water cycle. It will blow your mind. The complexity and perfection of the design of the water cycle. It's a lot more than evaporation and raining, I'll tell you that. The liquid water that exists because the Earth is the right distance from the sun in the Goldilocks zone. It's just the right distance. How about photosynthesis? You know, photosynthesis depends on quantum physics. That's a new discovery. Biologists, they used to think, well, at least we don't have to learn about quantum physics. Well, guess what? You do. Water doesn't break down because of quantum effects, as another discovery has concluded, and I'll quote again New Scientist, we are used to the idea that the cosmos physical constraints are fine-tuned for life. now it seems water's quantum forces can be added to this just right list. And you're listening to Real Science Radio's list of the fine-tuned features of the universe. You know, every month here at Real Science Radio, we do one of our annual list of shows, our list of not-so-old things, list of dinosaur soft tissue discoveries, list of genomes that just don't fit, list of evidence against the Big Bang. Well, this is our list of the fine-tuned features of the universe. And you add water as another one. So Lawrence Krauss, when he was on this Real Science Radio show, you could go to that, just realscienceradio.com/Krauss. He used the anthropic principle to explain all this. And he said to me, and he's the Discovery Channel guy, you know, Lawrence Krauss, a universe from nothing, that guy, Richard Dawkins' best friend guy. And he said to me, well, Bob, if it wasn't that way, then we wouldn't be here to notice now, would we? And in response to that, I said to Lawrence, quoting Walter Remine, in fact, who we've interviewed, really neat anti-Darwinist author. I said, well, Larry, that's as satisfying as a doctor saying, well, the reason that your father is deaf is because he can't hear. It's like, come on, you're playing games. A British astrophysicist, Paul Davies, he said this, there is, for me, powerful evidence that there is something going on behind it all. It seems as though somebody has fine-tuned nature's numbers to make the universe. The impression of design is overwhelming. Isn't that cool? NASA, one of their astronomers, John O'Keefe, said it this way. We are, by astronomical standards, a pampered, cosseted, cherished group of creatures. If the universe had not been made with the most exacting precision, we could never have come into existence. It is my view that these circumstances indicate the universe was created for man to live in. That's a NASA astronomer, John O'Keefe. How about Nobel Prize winner physicist Arno Penzias? He said this, and we give links to these sources. He said this, Nobel Prize winning physicist, astronomy leads us to a unique event, a universe which was created out of nothing, one with the very delicate balance needed to provide exactly the conditions required to permit life, and one which has an underlying, one might say, supernatural plan. That's a Nobel Prize winning physicist. So these are reasons, these are scientific observations that have led, what, thousands of people, millions of people, to the conclusion that life is not here by accident, that the universe is not here by accident. You know, the atheist belief that nothing created everything? Well, the fine-tuning of these parameters is overwhelming evidence that they're wrong, that there was a designer who created everything. Fred Williams and I, recently, we did our list of Darwin doubters and those scientists who were doubting the Big Bang. And it's because of observations like this that they come to their conclusions. Now, the media want you to believe, and so do our government schools, the curriculum, and our universities. They want you to believe that the atheists and the agnostics, they figured it out. They could explain how we got here, right? I mean, every Nova TV show, every NPR science show, every, what is that show called? Science Thursday on NPR. What is it called? Science Tuesday, Ira Flatow. Science Monday, Science Friday. Oh, how could I forget? Science Friday. Every show, they somehow want you to believe that the atheists have figured it out and they can explain how you got here without God. They don't need God. They don't need a designer. They don't need a creator. They have figured it out. Origins of everything, right? They remind me of Marxists. The Marxist The Buffoon Economist. They wrote books filled with stories, the Marxist interpretation of everything. They explain everything in terms of Marxism. And the Darwinists, they do the same thing. They explain everything, whether it's altruism or selfishness or everything. They tell stories. Well, the atheist, they want you to believe that they have figured out origins and they understand it. So first of all, if your theory of origins cannot account for human consciousness, well, then you don't even have a hypothesis. You got nothing. If you can't explain by your theory human consciousness, then you don't have a theory of origins, because that's part of the cosmos, our self-awareness. And they can't explain human consciousness. Secondly, there is a demonstrable pattern to the atheist claims about origins. See if you could spot the pattern. I'll give you examples, okay? The origin of species for Darwin begins with species already in existence. Right? He started with species reproducing with some change in natural selection. So the origin of species for Darwin begins with species already in existence. The origin of stars begins with existing protostars and the explosion of existing stars. You think I make that up? Just look it up. The origin of genes that code for new proteins, if you study that, they begin with modifying existing genes. The origin of species, forget Darwin, right? He wrote back in 1859, 100 years exactly before I was born. That's when Origin of Species came out. It's easy for me to remember. I was born in 1959. So 100 years before my birth was Charles Darwin. Now, for him, origin of species began with species already in existence. But that was before DNA and molecular biology, right? Before we knew all that. So fast forward 150 years later. The origin of species for the neo-Darwinian synthesis. It's called the modern synthesis. It is the theory, the standard explanation for the diversity of life on Earth today. The origin of species for neo-Darwinism begins with wildly sophisticated existing life. You have all this DNA and RNA, and you have these ribosomes, and you have this error-correcting DNA. Wildly sophisticated pre-existing life. That's what the origin of species today begins with. Wildly sophisticated existing life. The origin of life on Earth increasingly is seen as seeded from pre-existing life in outer space. The latest find toward that end was September 2013. Scientists send up a balloon into the upper stratosphere, and they come down with what they say is an organism, a biological organism, a part of its exoskeleton, so to speak. It's really a diatom valve. And so a lot of scientists are freaked out over that. And they're saying, well, that's not, they weren't careful enough. It probably came from the launch or something, or from somebody's lunch or something, working on the balloon. But the scientists who did it, they say they have a very high confidence level that they got this from incoming meteoritic dust. And this is proof that life comes to Earth from outer space. The latest claim like that was this month. If Walt Brown's hydroplate theory is correct, that explains why you have a diatom valve in a meteoritic shower, because of the hydroplate theory. The origin of the universe, right? The atheists have all the origins. They got it all figured out, except they don't, right? Everything they want to originate starts with the thing already existing. The origin of the universe increasingly is explained by atheists claiming that our fine-tuned universe is merely a byproduct of the pre-existing multiverse, which is forever popping universes into existence from the multiverse. So when the atheist and when NPR and Corporation for Public Broadcasting and the BBC, when they want you to believe that they have figured it all out, the Big Bang knows all. They can't tell you how the moon got there. They get befuddled over the sun. They don't understand the Earth. The Earth's magnetic field confuses them. The Earth's core confuses them. And they want you to believe that they figured it all out and there's no need for God. There's no need for a creator. So the origin of species for Darwin begins with species already in existence. The origin of stars begins with protostars and the explosion of existing stars. The origin of genes that code for new proteins begins with modifying existing genes. The origin of species in neo-Darwinism begins with sophisticated pre-existing life. The origin of life on Earth begins with pre-existing life in outer space, increasingly. The origin of the universe begins with the multiverse and billions of other universes already in existence. Billion? Did I say billions? I meant trillions. That's what they say. Did I say trillions? I meant quadrillions. Let's just go through that whole thing again. We've run out of names for these numbers. You think you know a Google, one with 100 zeros? That's nothing. They say there are trillions of Googles of universes. Trillions of Googles of universes. No, they say there are decillions of Googles of universes. Actually, they say there are 5 decillions of Googles of universes. Now we're getting pretty much in the ballpark of what they're talking about, which is all evidence that they're crazy, right? The people who deny that God can speak the universe into existence, they themselves speak trillions of universes into existence, they think. So we're out of time. This is our list of the fine-tuning features of the universe here at Real Science Radio. Our website, realscienceradio.com. And if you can't type fast, use the shortcut, rsr.org. Real Science Radio, rsr.org. And we have a store, and the store helps us stay on the air. This happens to be our telethon month. Our goal is to raise $35,000. It costs us $30,000 a year just for the airtime. And then there's all the overhead. And so we need your help. We don't have a foundation behind us. We don't have a large church. We have a staff for them. It's a labor of love. For some of them, I don't know why they're still here. I just don't get it. There's too much love, too much labor. It's a labor of love. And that's why we're here sharing with you the truth of God's creation. So please go to our store, purchase some of the materials, and if you can, make a donation, a one-time donation or a monthly donation. Help Real Science Radio stay on the air. Looking forward to Fred Williams being back. This is Bob Enyart. May God bless you.
Scholars can't explain it all away. Get ready to be awed by the handiwork of God. Tune in to Real Science Radio. Turn up the Real Science Radio. Keeping it real. That's what I'm talking about.
You can support the ministry of Bob Enyart Live by subscribing to Bob's monthly Bible studies, monthly videos, monthly sermons, or monthly classic TV shows at kgovstore.com. You can also support the show and make a monthly or one-time donation by calling 1-800-8-ENYART or at kgovstore.com. That's kgovstore.com.